Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Linarduzzi, an editor here at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy. How are things? What have you been up to?
Hi, Thea. Things are all right. I've been up to, you know, the usual, bit of looking at plants, bit of reading about things.
Plants?
Yes, a bit about plants. Finished reading about mushrooms, and now I just bore everybody with amazing facts about mushrooms and mycelium. Reading about dogs, reading about Buddhism, not necessarily together. They're probably, in a way, they are quite Buddhist, aren't they, dogs, because they're very present.
Well, my dog is.
Yeah.
Certainly. I mean,
most of them are. Like, they're probably not like dwelling on the past too much. They've got useful things they can teach us, of course. And I've just started reading Sounds Wild and Broken by David George Haskell, which is about the sounds that we will lose in the world as things become extinct. So I've just started that, and it's
so interesting. What sorts of sounds?
Well, I mean, an obvious one is particular sorts of bird song if the birds don't exist anymore, and all sorts of sounds, actually. I mean, bugs and things as well. I've read very little of it yet, so I cannot sound in any way expert on it. But, you know, as we lose biodiversity, we lose every element of them, and sound is a really important one.
There was a story on the radio, I think it was last year, about a particular bird in, I think it was in Australia, that has lost its song. So there are very few of these birds left. It's the something or other, something honey eater, something like that. And there are very few of them left. And because there are so few of them, they can't hear each other singing. So they can't learn how to sing their songs, causing all sorts of terrible problems in terms of meeting and mating.
Well, because it must have a huge effect, mustn't it?
And so they've set up these little almost like language schools where in they have some of these birds in captivity, and they're playing them recordings of their song.
What, they're playing the wild birds recordings of the captive birds? That's a good idea
to teach them how to sing, how they should sing.
Yeah, and they'll sound like the birds. I don't know if they will have an accent or a particular call, and they'll be like, "Hey, you sound like a bird in a zoo," and I'll be like, "No, you're not." I read a brilliant thing very briefly last week about orangutans. I think it is the young ones. They use slang in their calls. Because the older ones don't use it. The older ones are going, absolutely ridiculous. What does that mean? I mean, whatever. And the younger ones use it, particularly, and they catch on. And then I think it can spread to other communities. But again, it's the kids that use it. Isn't that good?
Yeah. And is there a theory about where they've picked it up or how that happens?
Not sure. Again, all I can tell you is the unexpert view. But it is really interesting, isn't it?
That's so interesting. Well, we've covered a lot, not in a lot of depth. But there you go.
What have you been reading?
So I've often said on this podcast that I don't reread books, haven't I? And I mean, largely because I'm so overwhelmed by how many unread books there are. But I've sort of admitted to myself recently that that's always been a bit of a lie, because I quite often do reread. but mostly short stories. And so recently it's been Flannery O'Connor. So I had a weekend of Flannery O'Connor, the famous complete stories, which were published posthumously.
A Gothic weekend.
Yeah, exactly. So I've had those and about 10 other things on the go, including the new issue of the Paris Review, which hit my doormat a couple of days ago. Oh, and I've just started the Ali Smith, the new Ali Smith novel, Companion Piece.
Oh, I want to read that. Can I borrow yours when you read it?
I will send it. It's a proof copy and its spine has disintegrated almost entirely. So if it still holds together, yes, I'll pop it in the post and you can share it with me. Or you could just wait for a finished copy. But yeah, I don't know why. I don't know why short stories seem to be an exception to my rule about not rereading. I wonder whether it's maybe, you know, like with poems, it's quite an intense experience, isn't it? You get a lot from a relatively quick re-immersion.
Yeah, and it's less of, you can dip in and out, can't you?
Yeah, a bit more. Exactly. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. I should probably also say this episode of the podcast will be my last. It will continue, of course. Podcast will, in your hands, won't it?
Well, all we can do is stagger on, Thea.
Nonsense. You and the wonderful Alex Clark will be taking the wheel. But yeah, I'm off. I'm away, taking on new projects, I guess. So once more, with feeling, let me tell you what we have coming up on this week's show. A Duty to Dissent will be joined by the critic En Liang Kong to discuss Ai Weiwei's artistic rebellion against the Chinese state and the artist's new memoir, 1,000 Years of Joys and Sorrows, the story of two lives, one nation, and a century of art under tyranny. But first, we're travelling north. We're not quite sure how far, no map can specify exactly, and we're not really sure which way up to hold it anyway. But we're aiming to cross into the extreme north, whose barely populated landscape, somewhere between the real and the imaginary, have long been something of a shorthand for other things. As our writer Cal Flynn puts it this week, reviewing a book by the German writer Bernd Brunner, the white expanse of the snow-spread plateau offers a blank canvas on which to project hopes, dreams, and neuroses. Perhaps the strangest thing about the extreme north is that everyone thinks they know what it is and what it stands for, but no one really knows where it is. Cal Flynn, the author most recently of Islands of Abandonment, Life in the Post-Human Landscape, has a clearer sense of these places than many of us, so I am pleased to say she is with us now to take us by the hand. Hello, Cal.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all ours. Now, I say you have a clearer sense than most of us because you've made a trip yourself, haven't you? You've felt the pull of the far north and you've kind of let it take you.
Yeah, that's right. I had a period in my life when, I don't know, I guess I just threw it all in and moved to the Arctic. So I moved to Scandinavian Arctic. This is the far north of Finland. I spent a winter season there working at a husky kennel. So out with the sled dogs in all weathers, really down to about minus 40 or just below. And it was just the most incredible, enervating experience. Yeah, so the far north, it really does hold like a important place on my mental map.
How would you describe that feeling, you know, that desire to go north that you felt that led you to make that decision? What was it about the north? What were you visualizing, I guess? And what, you know, what did you find when you did get there?
I guess it was something to do with the extreme climate. That's what attracted me. You know, that it is a very beautiful place to go in summer as well. But what I was looking for was almost that sort of like taking your skin off cold, the blizzards, the deep snow, the amazing natural phenomenon that you get when you drop temperatures so much. I'd never experienced anything like that before. And I think that's what I was looking for. I was looking to sort of re-find that sense of wonder with the world. And by going somewhere completely alien that I'd never been before, that really did sort of help me rediscover it. And it was based probably not on very much. It was more of an instinct than really based on any true knowledge of what the North would be like. But it fulfilled all of my sort of expectations and more. So it was, yeah, fantastic place.
I used the word pull before to feel the pull of the north. And that sort of takes us into the realm of magnetism, which seems right. The book you're reviewing, Extreme North, A Cultural History by Bernd Brunner, is translated by Jefferson Chase. And the book has some particularly good bits on early understandings of this pull, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I found absolutely charming is it talks about people's understanding of what it did to magnets. This is before the use of the compass was sort of as widespread as it is today, and before it was totally understood why. And so before people had gone to the North Pole, there was this sort of worry or sort of suggestion that perhaps what we now know to be the North Pole was actually some kind of giant magnetic rock, or perhaps even some kind of magnetic mountain range that passed in the very, very far off distance. And so one or two people would write on maps, you know, don't go past the north coast of Norway because the sea is completely impassable due to the magnets. And so there was a kind of misunderstanding of what this magnetic force was emanating from. And I do think that it's quite magical to sort of imagine yourself back in a time when sort of magnets are lurking away in the dark just beyond our circle of light. I just think that's fantastic.
It's a wonderful idea that there's just like a massive mountain that's a huge magnet which is drawing everything towards it. I wonder if that's part of the age-old attraction. I didn't do that on purpose, but
yeah, I wonder. And if you get too close to you, does, you know, everything metal sort of,
yeah, don't wear metal boots.
I think that's why it's so compelling, really, is because it kind of implies that we're made of something. We are made of some matter that exists in a kind of tension with this magnetic north. There's like a kind of symbiosis even with the north, like there's something essential about this mutual attraction.
Yes. And I think the sense of things really not being known, and very simple things about the world being perhaps dangerous and ununderstandable, I think that is, you know, you have to sort of like think of understanding the world through that lens.
The danger and the allure of it nonetheless, almost like mermaid-like. So, I mean, far northern or extreme northern territories, I think we'll come back to one way of potentially distinguishing between those two categories in a bit. But these places have always been places where the imagination has run free. As a result, you say historical maps have contained many northern inaccuracies. Can you tell us about some of these?
Yeah, sure. So for a long time, the maps were pretty confusing, really, due to a result of there being a great confusion about what was up in the north. There was a phantom island that sort of haunted these maps for really a long time, like centuries, the island of Frisland or Friesland, which was held to be to the south or the southwest of Iceland and was thought to be really quite large. And there's also, you know, that on closer inspection, it turns out not to exist whatsoever. And there's also the idea of this Thule, the sort of Ultima Thule, the furthest north that you might go. And this location was described very early on during the time of the ancient Greeks, and then it kept sort of metamorphizing and moving around the world because people kept wondering if they'd found it. So it was reported to be sort of a place where air and water and land all congealed into one, which I assume is a reference to ice, but it's not totally clear in the wording. And sometimes people have positioned it in the north of Norway. Sometimes people have said it's the Orkney Islands, which is where I am. Other people have placed it in Iceland. And these days, the name Thule survives as the Thule Air Base, which is an air base run by the US Space Force.
I could also sort of imagine Grimes and Elon Musk maybe calling their next child Thule.
That would be a bit of a shame, I think. But anyway,
a shame for the child, but yeah.
They can call it what they want.
It can change it when it's legally allowed. Yeah. There have been some especially dark twists in this tale, haven't there, in terms of the purposes of the concept of the north or northernness has been kind of repurposed to serve.
Yeah, absolutely. This book is called Extreme North, A Cultural History. And always with cultural histories, the question is, you know, whose culture? Bernd Brunner is German. And so he's writing from a very specific standpoint in Germany throughout the 19th century, very early 20th century. The north, and when we're talking about the north here, they're really talking about Nordic countries. So sort of like Norway, Sweden, and so on. Image of these countries and these peoples was very sort of purist. They came to be held up as this kind of wonderful example of essentially the Aryan race, what was characterized as the Aryan race. So their blonde-eyed, blue eyes, their traditional way of life, even their folk art, all of this kept popping up in German writings, in racial science writings of that period. And Wagner's sort of popularized the Norse gods in his Ring Cycle. So all of these things became huge in German culture around that time. And it was all sort of in a heady stew of this idea of racial purity and whether or not Germanic peoples and Nordic peoples were one and the same. So really kind of to the horror, I think, of particularly Swedish and Norwegians, you know, they would complain about how, I guess this is cultural appropriation, you know, in a earlier sense, because they did not believe themselves to be this sort of Ur race, but certainly the Germans did. It was a very sort of strange thing to happen, not really based on anything, but it was like a sort of cultural meme that passed around at that time and really was quite powerful.
And because the concept has always been so baggy, it's allowed it to be taken in any number of directions by any number of people for any number of reasons. The bagginess of the concept is a source of some frustration, isn't it? I mean, it must have been quite weird for you as well, disorientating perhaps, to read in the book about places that you really don't consider to be of the far north.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I imagine this is probably the same to people who live in Denmark, for example, which is not particularly far north, but is often characterized as being northern. Or if you're in the far south of Sweden or Norway, you're much further south than where I am now. And there is a section in this book where it starts talking about Celtophilia and the mythological poet Ossian, who was made up. And he was Scottish. And this all felt to me a little bit confusing. I didn't quite see how it sat with the sort of rest of the book, because to me, none of this is northern. You know, it's actually further south than where I am. And where I am, I don't consider to be particularly far north. And I think that is sort of waving towards this sort of central conflict at the heart of the book, which is that, you know, not very many people can give a real sense of where the north begins and ends. That's Bernd Brunner's point anyway. He feels it to be a kind of amorphous concept. And I'm not sure I totally agree, because I do think that there are sort of, yeah, I don't know, not necessarily a hard start point, although perhaps the Arctic Circle might be a good place to start. That's some effort made towards having some kind of hard definition of what it means to be in the far north. But, you know, there are major concrete physical changes the further you go north. And I think that it's worth really interrogating the idea of what we mean by extreme north or high north when you're writing an entire book about it and laying out a definition sort of towards the beginning of the book.
It's all so relative, isn't it, is the problem. And you can make it anywhere, because you point out in your piece that lovely moment if you have driven from, you know, down south in Britain anywhere towards up north. At one point on the motorway, they stop trying to define things, and there's a big arrow that just says the north, somewhere up that way. It's all up there,
and it's all in capital letters, isn't it?
Yeah,
I love that bit, and it starts happening pretty far south, to be honest. You're not very far north when you start getting those arrows.
No, absolutely. And I have to say, if you're ever, I don't know, looking to buy things online, I'm often, you know, on buy and sell Facebook groups, that kind of thing. And people will say, it's in the north. And then I'll be like, oh, wonderful. And I'll reply to them. They'll be like, no, I mean the north of England, of course. You know, so it is a term that can be very confusing and relative, as you say. But, you know, people who are in the clear and obvious far north, I think do self-identify as being northern peoples. And those are the people who have to kind of, on a daily basis, make calculations based on their northernness. So whether that's the temperature or it's a lack of daylight or, you know, there are things that mark it out. So I think that's what I was looking for in this book, this more sort of, you know, how can we move from the vague and somewhat, you know, amorphous concept of north and compare it to something a little bit more concrete. I don't know, maybe that's an unfair thing to ask of a cultural history, but that's what I felt was missing there, maybe.
Well, I mean, and there have been attempts to do precisely that, haven't there? Because you mentioned the late Canadian geographer Louis Edmond Hamelin, and that's he takes a completely different approach. He takes the approach that Brunner is so resistant to, of really attempting to pin things down and to come up with categories so that you can almost measure northernness.
That's right. He had a number of continuums. So that might be latitude. That's where we get the Arctic Circle from. But it might also be based on, you know, like numbers of hours of daylight, ice cover, accessibility, because often places, especially in, for example, the north of Canada, might be very difficult to access either by boat or over land. You know, you've got to fly in and out. So if you live in a place like that in the far north of Canada or in bits of Greenland, your day-to-day life is definitely very impacted on by your northernness. You know, it's very expensive to live there. Food in the shops is very expensive. Getting to and from that place, very expensive and obviously dependent on weather. So I think he's coming from a much more practical and pragmatic approach to this idea of north, probably because in Canada, unlike in Germany, where Brent Brunner's from, they do actually have to sort of deal with these issues every day. And I would be quite interested, I suppose, to read maybe a sort of analysis of concept of northerners from someone from Canada or from Sweden. You know, I think that would be very interesting because those are countries that have a continuum very much within the country itself.
If you lived there, if you were, as you say, you're battling with the climate every day, it's a genuine question, like, have I got the right tires on? Because otherwise I might slide down the road and into the sea, or, you know, there's real jeopardy. Do you think it's probably a bit annoying for them dealing with these everyday realities to have people sort of being misty-eyed about the romance of the north and the blank space and how you can just wander about thinking deep thoughts?
I think very possibly. I mean, so many people who live there are very practical people, you know, they have to be. And there is also, you know, an attraction to living in a place where other people have romantic ideas about, you know, there is a sense of pride in that as well. So I think it's a mix. But I do think, you know, if we're writing sort of analysis about it, it's important to at least understand the distinctions. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah, because as you say, if you're writing about, in fact, what is the middle of Scotland, in what sense, that's not the far north in any way, but it's only the far north if you come from Surrey or something, which is fine, but, you know, you've as you say, you've got to kind of delineate at some point, and if the far north is a place where you have to have real reckoning with how to live day to day. As you say, the sunlight is a big deal as well, isn't it? Because there's some places where in the winter, there's just not very much daylight, and that's very, very difficult.
Yeah, so where I lived for that winter in Finland, I was about 300 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle, which meant that we had, I think, roughly a month when there was no direct sunlight. And that's really, I don't know, it's really amazing. In some ways, you just have to deal with it. And then in other ways, you can really admire it. You know, it brings with it all of these amazing skies that might be sort of unusual colors. And, you know, I interviewed the Serena Fines, the sort of adventurer explorer, once about how he had made an attempt to get to the South Pole in an Antarctic winter, and I asked him, you know, will you struggle with the darkness? And he was like, no, not really at all. You know, it's sort of all about the state of mind that you're in. You know, you get these amazing twilights, so you get these red skies. And because I spoke to him just before I went to Finland, I think that really helped me sort of think about it in a different way and just admire it and allow that to happen.
Well, I mean, so it sounds like if we're looking for a practical, concrete guide to different experiences of living in northern territories, Bernd Brunner's book is not the book for us. So if we take it on its terms, on its own terms, you liken it to a cabinet of curiosities, which is a nice way of putting it. And I think there is an image at the beginning of the book that occasions that comparison. But what, you know, is there anything that you discovered in this cabinet of curiosities that really just really captured your eye, that really kind of got your imagination going again?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So he starts the book actually almost kind of confronting this lack of definition and sort of setting up the idea of a compendium head on by starting with the image of All Worms Museum Wormianium, which was, you know, a cabinet of curiosities of things sort of gathered from the miscellaneous north. They had a sort of narwhal tusk, different types of minerals, all sorts of things that had been handed to him. I think sort of weapon spears and things that had been brought down from various sort of first peoples from the far north, and he's stored them together in a room. It doesn't exist anymore, but there are images of it, and he starts with this as this sort of sense of this capacious definition of the north, you know, like everything that we find fascinating as a place. So you know, it is, you know, a strong image, And it's full of these sort of just little snippets that you can drop into at parties. I think my favorite thing I learned was about how before maps were sort of settled in form, quite often north would not be at the top of the page. It might drift around. Sometimes it would be east at the top of the page, for example, when during the era of the Crusades and Jerusalem was sort of held to be like the main point on earth. And in the Islamic world, often north would be at the bottom of the page. And even these tiny details, which of course makes perfect sense, I think I just find that sort of like a mind expanding. It's like sort of gesturing back at what we were talking about before, these ideas of unknown mountains. You know, it's just anything that shakes our understanding of the way the world works, I find really useful. That's why I'm so interested in cultural histories, just because they take up things that you don't question on a daily basis and say, ah, it hasn't always been this way. You know, that's just fascinating. I really enjoy doing them. And this book is absolutely full of these sort of little snippets that you can sort of bring out and throw into conversation here or there.
So we recommend it, but we maybe don't say put it in your bag when you're traveling. It's not going to be much use to you.
Yes, it's not a practical guide, but it is, you know, it's a full of arcane trivia. Why not?
That sounds great. Well, Cal Flynn, many thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, the evolution of the artist Ai Weiwei from Chinese revolutionary insider to social activist and thorn in the side of China's ruling class. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass!" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Today we're going to look into the life, history and work of a world-renowned artist, Ai Weiwei. Did you know, for instance, that he's a skilled player of blackjack or that he used to work as a pavement artist in New York? Me neither, but there are other much more serious strands to his life as well, of course. His memoir, A Thousand Years of Joys and Sorrows, The Story of Two Lives, One Nation and a Century of Art Under Tyranny, is reviewed for us this week by En Lian Kong, and we're delighted to have En here with us today to talk us through this fascinating story. En, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So the subtitle of the book mentions two lives. One is his, obviously, but who does the other one belong to?
Yeah, so the first half of the book is told through the life of his father, the renowned modernist poet I Ching. And, you know, for Ai Weiwei, you know, certainly in the first half of the book, he's piecing together the history of a nation through his father and his relationship with his father and navigating the extremes, you know, the extremes of a revolutionary era. It was particularly the extremes of the Cultural Revolution. So, you know, this was a period of incredible turmoil, so many families, of course, but, you know, it really marks the lives of so many artists of that, so many Chinese artists of that generation, navigating the extremes of the Cultural Revolution, would see their sort of literati parents thrown out into the streets. They would be shipped off to farming, remote farming communes. For so many artists of that generation, you can really see it imprinted on the work that he went on to produce. And of course, you know, I think with Ai Weiwei, certainly his, the work he produced in the 90s, there is this navigation between the chaos of the Cultural Revolution and then, you know, in a way, the chaos that followed in the post-Mao reform era, era of getting rich very quickly, to the extent that China grew into the world's sort of second largest economy. So I think in the most famous works, I think the works that people possibly most well acquainted with, there's lettings of Han Dynasty urns smashed on the floor or defacing them with the Coca-Cola logo. You know, at least one reading of such works is that trying to draw some kind of connection between the lives they lived during the revolutionary era and then the sort of road towards capitalism after that.
To bring you back to his father's story, it was a very quick and sudden fall from grace, wasn't it? He went from being a real kind of insider to being pushed out to the furthest margins and taking his young family with him.
Yes, it's interesting because I knew that Ai's father is sort of renowned poet in China. I didn't, until reading the memoir, have a feel for just how well acquainted he was with the, you know, the leading figures of the time. So, you know, you have him basically eating bacon and eggs with Mao in the caves of Yan'an. You know, at one point he sort of meets his friend who's the father of Xi Jinping. And so it's interesting to look at Ai's lineage that way, I think. We call the current figures in Chinese leadership and on the Politburo princelings, this the kind of heirs to a red revolutionary lineage. And in some ways, Ai belongs to that as well in a quite bizarre way. It explains, for instance, why I think certainly in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was able to really get away with quite a lot in China in terms of pushing the gray zone of what might be acceptable. Of course, that time in China felt a bit different. I think, you know, I was living there and it felt that very different to how it feels now. I think there was an air of hope about what might be sort of politically and culturally acceptable. And so, you know, the work he was doing felt, a piece of that, really. But there is, you know, I think especially reading through the memoir, there's this idea that he comes from such a renowned family that there are costs to, I guess, touching something like that. But of course, it's, you know, the climate has changed a lot and he's both a casualty of that and also the work he did around the Sichuan earthquake in 2008 really pushed that.
I was going to talk about the Sichuan earthquake in a minute. I just wanted to sort of emphasize the thing about his father that he was, as you say, very much an insider and from this very, as you say, a sort of red aristocracy. But that didn't stop him getting getting sort of almost banished and having to live hand to mouth and undergo a lot of very painful and sort of degrading experiences, did it? And I lived through a lot of that with him. Can you tell us about the time that his father decided to burn his books and the effect that that had on I?
Yes. I narrates this, a period of Red Guards going door to door, searching sort of families' collections of literature. And like many others, I think I's father decided that it was best to burn his library. And in the memoir, I narrates this as a one of the formative moments when he feels such a strength of feeling that explains, I suppose, his commitment to grand themes of truth, the truth seeking. Later on, this sort of defines how he wants to produce art in the future. What's interesting about the book is that it's the first half is really compelling because it's told through this really, really fascinating mm-hmm. history of the revolutionary era, of the of the experiences that the family went through, and there's great horror there. It is sort of become a truism that artists of his generation, at least in the early works that they produced, it's the really grappling with the absolute chaos of being thrown out of their sort of bourgeois families and lifestyles in a major capital city, say, and taken away and to live very different lives, and of course you can see it in a lot of the works they've gone to produce. And this absolute horror. So he does this in the first half of the book. There are scenes where he might discover a body hanging from the roof while he's playing hide and seek, in exile. Just little details that really really strike you. So it's a funny genre, like the artist's memoir. So I just feel there's a kind of disconnect between that first half of the book, which really holds you, and then the second half, where Cultural Revolution ends, he is off to New York to study at art school, and then it becomes this, I suppose, the difficulty of writing about the process of making art, or just the difficulty of portraying it, really, because it, I guess ideas are thought up and then sort of swiftly put into action, and then the sort of very successful exhibitions held, and those ideas of luck and failure and contingency that are so present in that in the story of the first half of the book. I guess they're just, living your life in such a chaotic era, slips away. And I think the story really shifts once you leave that history behind.
But when he goes to America, to New York, he wasn't a star pupil or a great success straight away, was he? Or was he?
I think what he was good at doing was, and this, I think explains, his success as an artist to some extent, and his standing certainly within China from at the beginning, was that he was able to essentially become a kind of fixer or middleman. He really established himself, I think, in New York as the sort of artist and exile and Chinese artists would sort of flock to him as a kind of meeting point for artists who'd gone abroad. And he really took this back to Beijing when he moved back in the 90s. So, admittedly, he was still living with his parents in his mid-30s, and is sort of in a funny, he talks about his mom not being particularly pleased with the long lines of long-haired artists at the door all the time. But seriously, I think one of his strengths, I suppose, was to establish himself, when he came back to China as this artist who had the sort of radical ideas that were running through New York, and could act as almost a sort of mentor to the nascent scene in Beijing. And that really carried on. So even in the 2000s, 2010s, his studio in the sort of suburban, it used to be a farming district of Beijing, Chaochengdi, it kind of became a sort of legendary place where if you're interested in contemporary art, you'd make that pilgrimage to visit him. I think people joked about sort of paying your dues at the House of Ai. So he really, I think he was able to really establish himself within the scene in that way. While also, and this is where you begin to see sort of signs within the second half of the book, but also with an eye to art produced for a Western audience.
His studio has become a sort of center, and as you say, he's done the work, the kind of Coca-Cola logos on the Han vases, and then as you say, after the, so he moves on to sort of international work and pushing at boundaries and things, and then as you said, there's a change after the earthquake in Sichuan in 2008. So what happened then?
I mean, his work has gone through many shifts, and I think actually for me, that's why he's such a compelling artist. He's able to, he has a sort of mastery of so many forms, I think. I was able to say so many interesting things through so many different mediums. But yes, I think there have been important shifts in his practice. And one you can absolutely see in the 2008 Sichuan earthquake. So following the disaster, he really took it on himself to begin investigating stories of shoddy architecture, linking reports of corruption to the ways in which these schools had been built and collapsed, and compiling a list of all the children who had died in an earthquake, information that had not been publicly released. So, what was very moving is I visited his studio, I think, in 2013, I think. And all around the studio, were printed the names of the children who died in the earthquake. What's admirable is that he really, and whatever your thoughts on him as an artist and where he's taken that kind of political arts, there's no doubt that he really took huge risks politically at that moment. And also, I think what maybe goes a little unremarked on, perhaps in Western commentary, is just how much he, revolutionized the aesthetic form around political art in China. So he produced, he began producing documentaries around the aftermath of the earthquake, and the aesthetics of this are sort of very swiftly produced, swiftly shot. The cameraman is sort of shoving the lens in front of figures of authority. The distribution of these films were made widely available, over the internet, and it marked there's a long tradition of socially engaged cinema in China, but it marked, I think, a shift in how his peers were making films on these issues at the time, because they were, I think, the production, it would often be produced through secretly filmed footage, the distribution of this was, still is sometimes quite underhand, quite undercover, one-to-one. I think perhaps over here he's well known for the films he's produced since he's left China, on the Hong Kong protests and on the refugee crisis. But I do think there's a shift in the aesthetics of these films.
He was, as you say, pushing hard, especially after the earthquake in Sichuan, to put a focus on this and pushing at the limits of what was allowed. And then, in fact, they got him and he was put in jail. And as you say, it was almost eroded from the Chinese art scene, and so then moved abroad. And this is where do you think his work changes again? I mean, as you're saying, and the sort of international stuff he's doing now. I mean, in your piece, you say it comes close to disaster tourism.
I've struggled with this really because part of this is actually growing a bit older with this kind of art. For me, Ai Weiwei is really synonymous with how I understand contemporary art, because it's his epic installations like the Sunflower Seeds at Tate Modern years ago that, you know, in some ways were some of the first, you know, monumental installations, contemporary art that I'd seen, really. It was a gateway into it. When I first sort of looked at his work more closely, I visited him in Beijing. I was writing on sort of Chinese independent filmmakers at the time. I was working more on politics and political journalism. You know, there were absolutely things that, you know, his subject absolutely spoke to me. You know, his activism seemed, you know, absolutely admirable. You know, I was enthralled, really. And I think it's that moment when you are, I talk about this in the piece, but it's that moment when you're walking around like an art world party with swinging champagne around one of his sort of inflatable refugee boats, that you think, this isn't quite what I thought it was. Obviously, you know, we're all complicit in this as well. But yes, I think, you know, it's also, there's also the dilemma of the exile, you know, the sort of Chinese dissident in exile, the politics, I suppose, the political game he was playing in China was very compelling. It was, you know, it was kind of cat and mouse game of what's it, you know, what can I just push this? What's acceptable? And it had real, as we discussed about the, you know, within the context of social cinema, it had real effects in terms of politics and form. The work he has produced, whether it's the Hong Kong protests or the European refugee crisis, I suppose the idea of the authority he's standing up to is far less clear. And in some of the works he's produced, it seems like the subjects, perhaps refugees, become, you know, aestheticized subjects in the gallery that he then can be disposed of once the show closes. So I do, you know, I do feel that perhaps explains why, you know, the works he's produced in exile in Europe have felt very problematic in comparison to his work in China.
You say they've been sort of almost, you know, like I've got to react to the news type thing. You also say near the end of your piece, for Ai, as for his revolutionary forebears, activist and aesthetic concerns have become one and the same. So has he come full circle, do you think?
I think that's, you know, that's why I wanted to write about him for you guys. You know, I find there is something so compelling about him that, you know, whatever you think of the direction of his art, he, in a funny way, foreshadows how the art world thinks of, you know, its taste in art these days. Art that basically is more than art, or can offer something more than art. Art that is evidence, it's testimony. If you look at even just the shortlist for the Turner Prize, it's, you know, these are collectives which are, you know, producing art alongside what looks like various forms of activism. And so, you know, for me, in many ways, the trajectory of his art mirrors that story, I guess, in the contemporary art world over the last few years.
And in a way, it goes back to Mao, doesn't it? That the declaration that art must serve the people. Ironically, he's kind of gone back to that, I suppose.
yes, that, you know, and you know, his father also in many of his writings engaged with that idea. And I think even the work he's produced in China is a heavily didactic practice that in a different way, of course, is bound up with this idea of art serving the masses. It's why, you know, it, in many ways it explains some of his most loved, you know, epic installations like the Sunflower Seeds. And he, I think in 2007, he produced this work called Fairy Tale for the this German mega exhibition called Documenta, in which he shipped 1,001 Chinese people to the city of Kassel and asked them to just wander around for several months. And so in these works, you can see him working with the, you know, with Maoist iconography, essentially, with sunflowers and masses of people. There's an interesting sort of, you know, this goes back to what we were discussing about these artists essentially grappling with the chaos, but also the imagery of that time, essentially of the revolutionary era.
What happened to the people who were part of the installation who had to wander around the town? Did they then just go home? And
I guess they did.
Seems a great gig.
Seems extraordinary, very bold and an odd thing to do. Yeah.
He talks about putting his open call. I think the open call went out online. And you know, the logistics of organizing something like that are extraordinary. He's essentially having to sort out visas and accommodation for some people who didn't even have, you know, have a passport, and others who, you know, perhaps through the never even gone outside the, you know, remote farming village. So you know, on the one hand, it does define a lot of the art. You know, he would then go on to produce, where it's logistically really impressive, but perhaps the politics of it are, you know, clear cut. There's a sort of message behind it that is hard to dispute, and perhaps what I feel is that there's, you know, what it comes down to, thinking about it, is that there's no risk. You know, he was taking great risk with his art in China with his filmmaking, and that feeling of that feeling is a little lost in the ever greater, ever larger works he would go on to produce.
In the end, Kong, many thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Cal Flynn and En Liang Kong. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. It's a bye for now from Lucy Dallas. We'll be back next week with Alex Clark, but it's a proper goodbye from me. Thanks to everyone for listening. It's been a pleasure. Goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.